The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right. Well, it's Wednesday, everyone. Happy debate day. Yes, I think today is the day that the 2020 election season officially kicks off, because tonight is the first of the Democratic candidate debates. We'll get into some of that 6:30 Pacific time. It starts at 9 p.m. Eastern. Otto Deschott in the YouTube chat room is saying 6:30 Pacific time. I don't think it's 6:30. I think it's 6 p.m. If you tune in at 6:30, I think you're going to miss some of it. Anyway, Donald Trump officially kicked off his campaign last week with a rally, one of his Nuremberg rallies in Orlando. And in it, all he kept talking about was Hillary Clinton. So we'll start off to Hans in the YouTube chat room, who says, Nicole, you look old. Fuck you, too. Just saying. And I am old. So, you know. Fuck you again. Anyway, so to start us off with a bit of the funny, we go to our pal Lauren Mayer, who once again draws on Annie for a song parody to poke a little fun at Donald Trump and his the candidate he wishes he could run against again. Take it away, Lauren Mayer.
HRC, does Trump think she's running? Sure mentions her a lot at Hillary. Trump's venom is stunning. I guess that's all he's got. He held a launch rally where he could sob and grumble and complain. But what's to launch? Since he started the job, he's done nothing but campaign. Well, clearly he can't run on his record. Attacks, she'll scoff and laugh him off. Hooray, that's HRC. HRC, what's with Trump's obsession? Someone should intervene. Obviously, his shtick needs refreshing. It's not 2016 when she won the popular vote by a mile while Putin helped Trump cheat. This week she answered Trump's rally so vile with shade thrown in a tweet. Sweet HRC. Trump's truly fixated so much, it's sick. He's such a prick who's stuck on HRC.
Oh, Lauren Mayer with her latest HRC. Thankfully, thank goodness for small favors. Thankfully, HRC will not be in either of the debates, either tonight or tomorrow night, because I guess she's not running. Thank God. But we do have Donald Trump to contend with, and we do have the media to contend with. I got to tell you, I didn't see it because I was in here getting ready for today's show. But apparently, you know, MSNBC is at the the theater where they're holding the debate tonight down in Miami. And Casey Hunt just did an interview with Bernie Sanders. And again, like I said, I didn't see it, but I saw some tweets about it. And I went back and I pulled some audio because it is unbelievable. I mean, it's totally believable that the way the media and MSNBC in particular treats Bernie Sanders. And it's evidenced by this question. This is the last question Casey Hunt asked Bernie. I say listen to Bernie's question back to her. Here we go.
If it's clear that you are not going to be the Democratic nominee, will you leave the race before the convention?
I intend to be the Democratic nominee.
But if you're not, you stayed last time, and some people say you hurt Hillary Clinton's candidacy.
Well, no, some people say that if maybe that system was not rigged against me, I would have won the nomination defeated Donald Trump.
Hello.
That's what some people say.
That's what
so
some people
I think
say.
We're going to play it out. I think I am excited.
And so you would take the risk.
I am
you
excited.
Might Donald Trump
are you asking that of every candidate?
Are you asking that of every candidate? She doesn't answer that.
Well, right now we are planning to win the Democratic nomination. And I'm proud of the campaigns we're running in Iowa and in New Hampshire. And I'm proud of our grassroots support and the fact that we have a million volunteers. So our goal right now is to win it. And by the way, as you may know, poll after poll shows what against Trump. Shows me beating Trump by 8, 9, or 10 points.
You go,
Bernie. We're going to beat Trump. We're going to win the Democratic nomination.
Are you a Democrat?
Of course I'm a Democrat. This is a Democratic National Convention, a Democratic primary here, right?
All right, that's an easier answer to that question than I feel like we got in 2016. Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you
okay,
very much.
Okay, so that's how that interview unfolded. Again, I wasn't watching it, so I'm going on secondhand knowledge from Twitter. But apparently, following that interview, the MSNBC panel started saying that Bernie was doing his bitter old man routine prior to the debates. They started bad-mouthing him. I'm so sick of it. But unfortunately, we don't have a free press in this country. Yes, MSNBC, James Buckley in the YouTube chat room just said, MSNBC is pushing Biden and praising Pelosi. That's what they're doing. They're putting their finger on the scale. I actually, I try watching Morning Jerk. And this morning, I just had to turn it off. I think yesterday I did, too. Go figure. Anyway, so tonight is the first of the debates. Because they're being held in Miami, all the candidates are down here. And, I have to cop to something. I was remiss last night. But as you heard, if you were listening to the show yesterday, it was raining. It was storming. There was an electrical storm here. It was thundering and lightning and raining and storming. And I live in a suburb of Fort Lauderdale, a western suburb, just on the eastern edge of the Everglades, called Coral Springs. Right next door to Parkland. And we are about, well, Miami is huge. It encompasses a lot of areas, including the city of Miami, Miami Beach, North Miami, South Beach. You know, there's a lot of Miami municipalities within Miami-Dade County. Anyway, the debate is being held at Florida International University. I believe their South Campus. So that's a schlep from here. And last night, in advance of the debate tonight, Elizabeth Warren held a town hall meeting. It wasn't going to be televised anywhere. There's no video of it available. And I really wanted to go. Because I like Elizabeth Warren. I've always liked Elizabeth Warren. I may not be in total agreement with her and have a problem with some of her issues that I'm trying to get better answers on. Just know I'm working behind the scenes trying to get those answers still, and I'll keep it up. But so when I got the media advisory about the town hall, I RSVP'd both as a media and as a, you know, a South Florida resident voter. But when it came down to it, by the time, you know, I finished the show yesterday, we would have had to rush to get out of here, deal with rush hour traffic, deal with stormy weather. I'm making excuses because we didn't go. And I feel guilty, especially when I saw one of my Twitter followers posted a selfie with Elizabeth Warren, because, you know, she does these selfie lines and she'll take a picture with everybody.
But, you know, it would have been a good opportunity because maybe I could have asked her my burning questions. But I'm still working on it. We've got time tonight. Elizabeth Warren will be on the stage with a lot of the, I hate to say it, second-tier candidates. It's just the way the drawing happened, which I think is great for her. Not so much for all the top tier candidates who are going to be on tomorrow's stage, but we'll be watching both of them. Tomorrow, I will have I'll have a lot of audio for you. So if you don't watch it, we'll narrow it down for you and give you the best coverage. Tomorrow on the program, Howie Klein is out again. He'll be back next week is 4th of July. He'll be back the following week. In his stead, we were going to have Congressman Jamie Raskin, who just can't make it tomorrow. He'll be with us Friday instead, as will Digby. So Friday is going to be a busy show. Tomorrow, I've invited Mike Lux on. Now, you may not know Mike Lux's name, although you should. And he's getting a little more of a high profile these days. He's producing some videos as the politics guy. But Mike Lux has been working behind the scenes in progressive politics for decades. And so, as I said, I'm gonna share this one video with you right now. He's been doing, through Mike Lux Media, these informative videos leading up to the 2020 election. Here's the one he put out last week. I'm not even going to tell you what it's called. We'll just play it for you, and you'll get the idea. Okay, Mike Lux, everybody.
Because we all so badly want to beat this corrupt, megalomaniac, narcissist asshole Donald Trump.
It's a bit redundant, don't you think?
Democrats these days are utterly obsessed about the whole electability thing when it comes to that presidential candidate. Believe me, I get it. But as someone who's been directly involved in presidential politics for more than 35 years, I can tell you there's a lot of myths about electability. A lot of it is stoked by centrist media pundits stuck in the Beltway bubble. I'm looking at you, Chuck Todd.
Ooh, burn!
Let me deconstruct some of these myths right now. First, the conventional wisdom is almost always wrong. All the usual experts said that Hillary was going to win in 2016. Before that, in 2008, the same experts said there was no way Trump would win, no way Bernie would provide Hillary with anything more than a token challenge, and no way a black man with an African Muslim name could win in 2008.
Yes, we did. Yes, we can.
They were wrong every single time. Second myth, there are a lot of different paths to beating Trump.
So many roads to choose.
In 2016, Hillary would have won if she had gotten a higher black turnout, or if she'd won most of the protest vote that went to third-party candidates, or if she lost rural counties by a smaller percentage, or if she had gotten more young people to turn out, or if she had gotten more Bernie primary voters to turn out.
Holy shit.
There's more than one way to win and more than one candidate who can win. Finally, keep in mind that the favorites in the early polling usually lose. In the 11 presidential elections without a Democratic incumbent since 1968, the early frontrunners won only three times, and in two of those three, they had a far tougher primary fight than was expected. So just ignore conventional wisdom. Support the candidates who are talking about the issues
yes.
that really matter to you and your neighbors.
Yes.
The ones who have great stories to tell. The ones who are getting young people fired up to vote. Those are your best guides to victory, not the talking heads on MSNBC. Because we all so badly want to be this corrupt,
okay.
megalomaniac,
we're back to the beginning again. Hold on. Woo! Sorry, it was starting to repeat again. So that's Mike Lux, the politics guy, basically saying beware of conventional wisdom and the electability question because it's bullshit. Just like somebody in the chat room, as I was reading during the video, said something about I like Elizabeth Warren too, but do you really think she can win the black vote? Stop trying to play pundit or politics. Vote for, in the primaries, vote for who you think is the best candidate. Vote for whomever most closely matches your priorities for making the world a better place. That's what you do. Then there's the question of you know, Joe Biden. And we're told that, you know, Joe Biden has the best chance of being elected. Again, stop with the electability bullshit and stop following the so-called conventional wisdom. Vote your conscience in the primary. Vote for your fantasy candidate. It's the only way we're going to affect real change. So again, Mike, who is doing these videos sporadically, will join us tomorrow to do a sort of post-mortem on the first night of the debates. And again, Elizabeth Warren is the lone front runner on the stage. The other person in the middle of the stage tonight is Beto O'Rourke, showing you how these the separation of the two groups of 10 for the debates shook out. Not very fair, but I guess good for Elizabeth Warren. All right, today on the program, those of you who've listened to me for a long time or listened to this program back in the Air America days probably remember Jack Rice. Jack Rice and I started at Air America at the same time. We were both fill-in hosts. I wound up eventually doing the 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern show. And Jack, I don't think, was doing a regular show, but he was the main fill-in guy when I was doing the late night thing. Anyway, we became good friends. Jack is a brilliant man who also happens to be an attorney and a former CIA case operative. And so Jack Rice will be joining us at the bottom of the hour to talk about everything that's going on, plus his trek to The Hague, to the Netherlands, where he spent a few months working at the International Criminal Court. So, you know, I've got a few questions about that to get to as well. But first, because we can and we should, it's time for a look at today's news. I guess we'll do it live. Should we do it live? We'll do it live. Do it live!
We'll do it live. Fucking thing!
I read the news.
We'll do it live!
Okay!
I'll write it and we'll do it live!
All right, we'll do it live. But before we get to the actual crux of the news, let me give you a couple of things. 4 years ago today, the Supreme Court ruled making marriage equality the law of the land. That's when Obergefell versus Hodges established marriage equality throughout the United States. 4 years ago. My, how time flies. The House Oversight Committee met today and authorized a subpoena for Kellyanne Conway. One Republican, once again, Justin Amash of Michigan, joined all the Democrats in voting to authorize Elijah Cummings to subpoena Kellyanne Conway. The hearing was a bit of a clusterfuck. In fact, let me share one clip with you. Tell me I didn't pull it over here. I'm going to get it for you. Even if I didn't, I'm going to find it because it was that good. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, sits on the House Oversight Committee, and she had a few comments to make about Kellyanne Conway and the Hatch Act.
I think that this taps into a deeper narrative and a deeper pattern of what is happening out of this administration, where they believe that the rule of law only belongs and applies to some people and not others. Right here and now, we're about 20 years away from the Central Park Five, where the president put out a full-page ad demanding the death penalty for five black and brown boys. Boys, they were not yet 18 years old, demanding the death penalty for something they were accused of and innocent of. And here we have just documented evidence of multiple times a violation of the same law, and he won't even issue a slap on the wrist. This is a pattern about some people being subject to the rule of law and others not. And when that happens, there is no rule of law at all.
Mm-hmm.
At all.
At
all. That's why it's important that we make sure that everyone is held accountable, because whether it's a billionaire, whether it's an administration official, or whether it's a postal worker or a kid on the street, we all must be held accountable to the same extent by the rule of law.
You go, AOC. That was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez this morning at the hearing, the House Oversight Committee hearing, on subpoenaing Kellyanne Conway over violations of the Hatch Act, for which the special counsel's office already recommended she be removed from her post at the White House. Stay tuned. The Supreme Court, today we were all on Supreme Court watch again as they're coming to the end of their term, and they always save the biggest decisions for last. Well, this morning, the Supreme Court did not issue rulings in the major census and gerrymandering cases that are still outstanding. Chief Justice John Roberts said the court would return tomorrow for its final day of the session. So we'll get those decisions tomorrow. I guess we'll talk to Mike Lux about those as well. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren and Jane Sanders this morning both visited that Florida migrant detention center down in Homestead. My God, I alluded to this yesterday, but if you want to read, it's not only that facility in Texas where these horrific scenes are taking place, it's happening here too. There's a story in Miami New Times. Just Google Miami New Times Homestead Detention Center. But be prepared to vomit a lot. It's really sickening. So anyway, Elizabeth Warren went down there this morning. Jane Sanders was down there this morning. Elizabeth Warren actually brought supporters with her. Her campaign organized buses to take her supporters down to this detention center in Homestead, where many of them showed up this morning. As to the other rest of the news, it's about time. Yes, I was elated last night when I saw the chyron on the screen that said Robert Mueller subpoenaed will testify July 17th. Yep. So yesterday, finally, the chairman of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, Gerald Nadler and Adam Schiff, served Mueller with a subpoena. And after, of course, their attempts to negotiate voluntary public testimony failed. So it will happen July 17th. It will be back-to-back panel hearings, judiciary, then intelligence, or the other way around. So it's going to pretty much go all day on Tuesday, July 17th. That day, I'm guessing, I'll have a lot of audio from the morning session handy, but we'll also, maybe carry some of it live. Just know, July 17th, we've already got the day on the calendar. The House yesterday voted 230 to 195, almost entirely along party lines, to approve a $4.5 billion package to ease the humanitarian crisis at the southern border. Now, in order to win over progressives, they added provisions to the bill that would require the Customs and Border Patrol to establish new health and safety standards for the migrants in custody, as well as protocols for dealing with migrant surges within 30 days. The changes would also limit children's stays at these centers to no more than 90 days and require the department to report to Congress on their use. Well, of course, again, the vote was along party lines, except for Justin Amash, as usual. And now, next they negotiate. But here's the thing, Mitch McConnell, who will not bring up any of the 100 or so bills that have already passed the House on the Senate floor, because the Republicans are the real obstructionists here. Mitch McConnell has decided he's going to bring up a couple of these bills, including this humanitarian relief, while a good number of the Democratic senators who are running for the presidency are in Miami for the debates. What a piece of shit he is. Just got to say, what a piece of shit. There's other news that I didn't get to, but I don't want to run out of time for the interview with Jack Rice. Actually, I spoke with Jack Rice earlier today because, honestly, to get a better phone connection because he was going to be out working and on his cell phone, and we thought it would be better to do it on a landline. So with that, we're going to switch gears now and go to my conversation with the one and only Jack Rice. On the line now is one of my favorite people, Jack Rice, who many listeners probably remember from the days we were both on Air America. Jack, do you realize we are coming up on the 10th anniversary of the end of Air America in January?
Yeah, it's astounding to me. Sometimes I look back on it and kind of shake my head. It's quite a ride sometimes.
Yeah, it really is. Well, in his current life, Jack Rice is a man of many trades. In addition to being a wonderful radio host, Jack spent how many years in the CIA?
More than five. It all balances. It all sort of fades around. There's just so much. Life is weird because part of what I've done after that is a lot of those skills I ended up using around the world in different, in sort of a different approach. I was doing a lot of journalism work, so I was a war correspondent for a long time, and a big part of that had to do with the ability to drop into impossible places and survive, And so that sort of came from the agency in some ways. And so it, in certain ways, it kind of blends together.
What did you do for the CIA? You were an analyst, or you were
No. I was a case officer.
Okay.
I was a field officer. So the way the agency generally works is there's basically four directorates, four big groups of people. There's the administrative people, there's the science and technology people, there are the analysts, and then there are the field people, the people who are actually out in the streets, out in the cities, out in countries of the world. That's where I was. I was that in that fourth group. Technically, I was called a case officer.
Okay, so you weren't like an undercover, like a Valerie Plame working under in a made-up company doing intelligence work, or were you? I don't know.
Oh, it's a great question. And I'm always careful on what I can say and not say, but essentially there are different kinds of operations officers. She certainly fell within the same directorate of operations that I did. The difference is there's those who work under official and those who work in under non-official cover. And so it changes what you do. Her case in particular, she was a non-official cover officer. And in fact, in some ways, that can be some of the most dangerous work on the planet, because you're literally working without a net. Not that necessarily the other helps you so much, but this is a place where you could very easily end up with the U.S. government denying even knowing who you are.
Right.
And so that can be a very, very difficult place to work. And they use them for different reasons. There's reasons to use different sorts of officers for different sorts of operations. She happened to fall within one. I happened to fall within the other.
Gotcha. So in addition to being a radio talk show host and a CIA a case officer, you're also a lawyer. Were you a lawyer before you went to the CIA, or was that after? Or how did that come about?
Yeah, that was after, actually. I think what happened was I was traveling so much and I was doing so much that after I left the agency, I made a conscious choice to move into this work. So as a lawyer, what I really do is I've been a prosecutor and as a defense attorney, but I do a lot of what I do on the world stage too. So a big part of what I have done since that time, let alone being in courtrooms in the States, is I teach trial advocacy around the world. So in other words, I teach lawyers how to be better at what they do. And the logic in many ways behind that is this, is that there's something called rule of law, the idea that the law works in the countries in which it's supposed to operate, if something's going to happen, it happens to everybody, and that it's fair, and that it's honest, and that it's just. And that while that's certainly not always the case, and it's certainly not the case in the United States sometimes, ideally that is the goal. And so I have worked around the world trying to help lawyers be better at what they do. And the better they are, the less corrupt generally they will be, the less corrupt their systems will be. So not long ago, I was in Tbilisi, the Republic of Georgia, teaching really experienced trial lawyers. I've worked in Russia, believe it or not. I've worked in Uganda, Southeast Asia, other parts of the world.
And you just returned from what I think was a pretty lengthy stint at The Hague in the Netherlands. That's where the international court is, right?
Right, right. The International Criminal Court was established back in 2002, and the purpose of the court was to essentially deal with issues of genocide and war crimes. I mean, it's expanded a little bit, but this is relatively new in terms of a court. This was an effort to try to create a permanent body that would go after those people who committed crimes. And there's more than 130 countries who are signatories. They've actually signed on to this, essentially holding themselves up and saying, we will abide by the rule of law. We will abide by the rules of war, although that sounds odd, but that's what they've agreed to do. And also to abide by the system of justice under the court. But to be specific about it, the concept that the International Criminal Court has always stood upon is the idea that they would never step into any case if the countries themselves are addressing the crimes that their own citizens may have committed within their work around the world, or even what they may have committed within the boundaries of their own countries.
Okay, so this is fascinating, Jack Rice. I find it interesting and really have been fascinated by the International Criminal Court at The Hague since the days of the George Bush administration, when many of us were positing that really George Bush and Dick Cheney couldn't leave the United States, because if they did, they might be arrested and hauled off to The Hague, where they should stand trial for war crimes. That obviously has never happened. But is that something that, do you know, was even being considered? Of course, and then I'm going to have to ask you about what's going on today.
Absolutely. I mean, in many ways, the ICC, it's a bit more complex than that, and I understand the arguments that have been made regarding it. But the real purpose, what they're really trying to do, is they have a process and an investigatory process to look at crimes that may have been committed, specifically torture, crimes against humanity, et cetera. So in other words, what was going on in Afghanistan? There was actually a real fight going on, because I was in The Hague originally back in March, and when I was there was when there was a big fight between John Bolton, Ambassador Bolton, President Trump, and the ICC, because they were talking about coming and investigating or talking to people in the United States about CIA officers. So there's the where these two worlds collide in mine anyway, and about their crimes that they may have committed inside of Afghanistan. So that is a part of this too.
You know, and along those lines, all right, the brain move to current times, that Donald Trump has floated the idea of pardoning war criminals. Would this fall under the aegis of the International Criminal Court?
Well, the United States is not a signatory, okay? So what they did was you have to go back to President Clinton, Bill Clinton, who basically said that we will abide by this issue, but we're not going to become signatories. In other words, you will not have jurisdiction over the United States. And so the United States never signed on. But what I think the real fiction, the real problem, is that the United States was neck deep in trying to establish this court in the first place. I mean, you have to go back to World War II and before, really World War I as well, where there was a very conscious effort to say there are certain things we should do, there are certain things we should not do as countries. And when you look at the instability that all that caused, certainly post-World War II, there was a need to have a body that would come in and address this issue. And so the United States had people directly involved in setting this up. And ultimately, they signed something called the Rome Statutes, and that was in 97, with the idea that this would apply and that this system would actually work. And so the hope was that the United States would actually become members, because when they chose not to, what it did was it undercut the legitimacy of the court, and it made it seem like, oh, so the U.S. is above the fray, above the jurisdiction of this, or they can act with impunity, is I think what I've heard in the eyes of some around the world, whether it's true or not. That's something separate, but certainly people are making that argument.
Right. Well, and the United States today is acting with impunity. I mean, just the way that we are treating migrants coming here seeking asylum, it goes against certainly everything this country was founded on, and we're left sort of flailing in the background here going, wait a minute, rest of the world, this isn't how all of us are. At the Hague, at the International Criminal Court, I'm guessing, Jack Rice, there were a lot of people like you, people from around the world who, as you said, were there talking about the rule of law, which is the prime, I guess, directive of the court. The United States under Donald Trump does not acknowledge the rule of law. Is this a topic that was discussed among people at The Hague, maybe off the record, not in an official capacity, but is this something of concern over there?
You'd never see anybody officially do that because it is a political body in that sense. You are having to deal with the political realities of it. And so officially you would never see that. But I think what you do see are a lot of really dedicated people who deal with international criminal law. So you'll see the acronym ICL a lot. And they deal with international criminal law where they have seen really horrible things happen in the world. And what they're trying to say is, we can't allow people to simply act with impunity. It can't happen. And so I think there is an ongoing frustration with this. I mean, if we go back a little further, so here's an example, is before the International Criminal Court, the United States was a part of certain things. So you can look at the tribunals that were going after the Nazis, after World War II.
Okay.
This was set up as an international body designed to prosecute those who committed crimes against humanity. And the United States was involved. The United States signed on and was directly involved in the very same thing, if you will, with what was going on in Yugoslavia. And so in Yugoslavia, what you find is some of the prosecutors, some of the really, really fine prosecutors who were involved in the prosecution of Slobodan Milosevic, Jadic, some of the others, those were American trial lawyers too. And so they were involved in this idea as well, that you would go out and look at the war crimes that took place in former Yugoslavia and prosecute those. And that was another special tribunal. And actually, both of those are located in The Hague as well. And so they were doing those very same things. The idea of the ICC was to take those examples. There's some other ones, Sierra Leone, what was going on in Lebanon, some other things. And they took these special tribunals and said, the problem with a special tribunal is that you have to wait until everything is over, dig up all the bodies, and then hope that maybe you're going to do some good. Whereas if you had a system in place that was an ongoing system, you could hopefully dissuade people in the first place from doing this, but you could also react more quickly. So you would have a body in place that could go out and start to investigate to see exactly what was going on. And in fact, when you look at this recent dust-up, the recent fight between John Bolton and the president and the ICC and what was going on in Afghanistan, what the ICC was trying to do, and the lead prosecutor, who's actually from the Gambia, from West Africa, what they were trying to do was to look at exactly who was committing torture in Afghanistan as a war crime, not saying that anybody had or that somebody was going to be prosecuted, but trying to collect the evidence to make a determination. Because if you don't do that, what ends up happening is that all of those people who were tortured, all of those people that were murdered, all of the society that was traumatized as a result, if you don't address it, if you don't acknowledge it, if you don't at least name it, then it simply continues to perpetuate itself and continues to victimize those who are surviving through it.
Right. But so here we have an example during the Bush administration where the United States tortured prisoners and nothing was
correct.
Done. So here correct. They didn't address
it. I didn't mean to interrupt with you, but you know what? You're right. I mean, this is from my perspective. The fact is that the United States sanctioned torture
right.
in Afghanistan.
Yes.
They did. I mean, full stop.
Yep.
And the problem is that people may not want to hear that. People may not want to acknowledge it, but what has been determined as torture, the United States designed, set up, and implemented in Afghanistan against Afghanis and others.
Yes. So again, what you just said, anyone who does commits torture has to be held accountable. The United States is off the hook. And this current administration is perpetuating that. I don't know if you saw in the last couple of days, there was another trove of documents released that showed, I guess, Trump's some of the staffing vetting process. And there was a red flag against General Petraeus, I guess, for Secretary of Defense, because the red flag was issued because he does not support torture. So this is an administration who is in favor of torture and ruled out somebody for defense secretary because he's not in favor of torture. I understand it, doing something about Trump now would be sort of prosecuting thought crimes or something because he hasn't actually tortured anyone yet. But he's already said that this is his administration policy, basically.
Well, it's a really sad day, and I have to tell you, as a former CIA case officer, so I mean, I remember standing up in the basement of the agency in McLean, Virginia, raising my right hand and swearing an oath to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back to all of my time in Afghanistan or Iraq or in Kosovo or in Haiti or in all over Southeast Asia, all over Africa. I mean, just everywhere in the world I've had to work and operate before and after. And the problem is the United States has to remember who we are. We do. I mean, we've forgotten who we are. We have to stand up and actually say that we are the standard. I'm not suggesting that we were ever perfect, and
right.
We're not.
No.
But I think that we have to acknowledge that we have made grave, grave mistakes. And by the way, I'll blame the Dems, too. The Democrats have been, in some ways, equally guilty of this. I recall being at the White House when President Obama came out and he said that we weren't going to take a look at what was going on at Abu Ghraib.
Right.
We weren't going to do that. I'm not going to release the photographs because what's important is that we look forward, not look back.
Ugh.
And my response is,
ugh,
Mr. President, you are fundamentally wrong in this particular case because
mm-hmm.
looking back is exactly how you look forward. And so this is not simply a Republican problem. This is an American problem where we have to acknowledge who we are, not who we wish we were.
Yes, without a doubt. And so, again, I'm glad that the International Criminal Court exists at The Hague. But as you said, Jack Rice, United States is not a signatory to it. And I guess if they wanted to bring charges for war crimes, for instance, about torture against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, or any of that administration, or go after Trump for their various crimes against humanity, I think just the child separation policy that they've enacted, despite Trump's lying about it, is worthy of a criminal prosecution on the international court. I don't know if that's a prosecutable offense, but it should be. I just see all the travesties that this administration is guilty of, and I can't believe they're able to get away with this stuff. But it's a new atrocity every day, it seems.
Well, I think what scares me in many, many ways, and I think should scare a lot of people, is specifically one of the people who's driving this president is Ambassador Bolton.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that Ambassador Bolton said was that he called the International Criminal Court illegitimate. He was attacking the court because they wanted to look at this Afghanistan issue. And what he did was he didn't say, you don't get to look at the Afghanistan issue because we've already addressed the Afghanistan issue, which is an argument he could try to make. Okay, I'm not saying it would work, but he could try to do it. But if you notice what he did, and this is what he's doing on behalf of the president, is he's actually attacking another one of so many international organizations. And he's attacking them because he's actually undercutting what they're trying to accomplish.
Hmm.
And so trying to accomplish this idea of holding people accountable for the horrific acts that they commit is something that John Bolton was actually trying to stop. And that is an extraordinary thing and something that we have rarely seen in the country. And I see very few to no people actually talking about that. But again, In a very weird world, this seems to be another problem that exists in it.
Again, we're speaking with Jack Rice, former CIA case officer, former radio talk show host, although you may still be doing some radio there in the Minneapolis area. Current attorney. Hold on, my phone. So jack of all trades, basically, Jack Rice. So you were gone, I think, still at in the Netherlands when the Mueller report, redacted as such as it is, was released. I'm guessing you read the thing.
I did, the whole thing.
Knowing you, of course you did. And your thoughts on it?
I'm astounded at just how much the Attorney General lied to the American people about its contents.
Right.
And I'm equally astounded by just how much the president lied about the contents of the report itself. It's amazing to me that if you say things definitively, that somehow it makes it true. It does not. If you look at what it is that Bob Mueller did in this report, is what he did say was the Russians ran an op against the United States. By the way, this was exactly what the president said never took place for a long time, and actually chose Vladimir Putin over the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department and the Department of Defense and basically every other wing of the intelligence world inside the country. So that piece was true. But the second piece was this question of obstruction. And in fact, it's very clear that what Bob Mueller determined was that, in fact, there was a whole lot of evidence out there that this president may have, in fact, done this. But because he was a sitting president, he was obligated to abide by the Justice Department policy, which means you can't indict a sitting president. By the way, that by every conceivable analysis is not exoneration.
Yep.
That was a specific and intentional lie so he could mislead and the Attorney General could mislead the American people. There really isn't another way to shine that up.
What do you make of Robert Mueller's reticence to testify? I mean, I look at it as he was hired to do a job, which is to oversee this investigation, to write a report, and then to disseminate the information, I think, is part of it. And he, you know, when his little press conference in which he didn't take any questions, he said, you know, the report is my testimony, and if I will not testify anything further. Isn't it his responsibility to explain what's in the report, since it's written in such a way that most Americans will not read?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I mean, it really is. I mean, let's think about this. Remember how the Republicans tore into this guy, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Republican.
Yes, he is.
Right?
Lifelong.
But let's pull back for a second. This man is a pro, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He is. He's a former Marine. He has. I give him huge respect for that piece alone, the work that he did. The man is a hero for what he did in this country and for this country before any of this. What he did as former head of the of all the things that he's actually accomplished. I think that his argument, his logic was this, was that this was his magnum opus. This was the purpose was to say, this report speaks for itself. I don't want to turn this into political theater. I don't want to turn this into a circus. What I really want to do is I want to give you the most thorough possible analysis that I can of all of the evidence that we have with all 400 plus pages of it, and that my job isn't to give you a Reader's Digest version. My job isn't to come in and give you sound bites.
Mm.
My job isn't to help you get elected to anything. My job is to simply give you the report as best I can possibly get it to you. And so you're not going to pull me into your political shenanigans, whichever side you're on. And I think if you ask him honestly, that's what he would probably say.
Well, I get that. But, you know, there's a difference between taking a political side and testifying as to what's in the report. But regardless, it's a done deal. Last night, a subpoena was issued, and Robert Mueller will now testify in two open sessions on July 17th. There are going to be back-to-back hearings with both the House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee. So it's about time. You know, I've been frustrated, Jack, watching how the Democrats have been dealing with this. And I place the blame on Nancy Pelosi. I think she's dragging her feet. I think she's afraid of impeachment. I think she's worried about political ramifications instead of upholding the Constitution of the United States and saying that a sitting president cannot act the way this guy is acting, and he needs to be held accountable regardless of the political ramifications of it. What are your thoughts on how Nancy Pelosi is going about this?
Before we get to that, if I could just sort of follow up on the Mueller piece.
Yes.
You know, the one thing you mentioned is the fact that he will be testifying before the Judiciary and the Intelligence Committee.
Yep.
I actually think it's a great thing.
Yeah,
personally,
me too.
I do. And the reason it's a great thing is this, is there is a lot of confusion. And I think that what we need in this country on this particular issue is we need as much transparency as possible. It would be nice to hear a little bit more about the thought processes and the parameters with which he saw his work. And I think the real problem is that the American people really don't understand exactly what this report said. And if this had been delivered to Congress in the very same way that the reports on Nixon by John Dean and others had been delivered to Congress, I think we would be looking at this issue in a fundamentally different way.
Without a doubt. We were lied to for just about a month, where all we had to go on was William Barr's narrative of what was in the report, and we know that he lied about what was in the report.
It was false.
Completely false.
It was false. It really was. There's nobody who could actually read the report and then read his four-part summary and actually conclude that they came from the same report.
His four-page
summary.
And that
really is true. Right. And remember, the Attorney General is not the president's attorney. He's the Attorney General of the United States.
Or supposed to be.
He does not represent Donald Trump.
Right, but he's acting as if he does represent Donald Trump. We should remember Donald Trump openly proclaimed with his dissatisfaction of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, I want my Roy Cohn. Well, it looks like he got his Roy Cohn. That's not the job of the Attorney General.
Correct. You're absolutely right. So I think with all of that in mind, do I think that would have driven Nancy Pelosi to act differently? I do. I think she would have acted much differently. I think the fear that she faces, not that it's appropriate or otherwise, is that what she's afraid of is that this would play out in the very same way that the impeachment of Bill Clinton played out, where what you would see is an effort in one house and a failure in the other house, which then would drive the sitting president's base to actually vote him in again. And what she's trying to accomplish, again, and I'm now probably trying to put words in her mouth. I think what she's trying to accomplish is, look, if I can't get him out through impeachment for real, then politically, what I want to do is anything that hurts him for the polls in 2020.
Right.
And that's her argument.
But right now, we've got a good portion of the American public who get their misinformation, their propaganda fix from Fox, and therefore don't know. I just read a piece that people who are Fox News viewers, absurdly high number, like 90%, didn't realize that he had even been accused of sexual assault before this latest rape allegation came out. So they've been so misinformed by Fox, who calls itself news, that they don't know what's going on. And that's why people like me are advocating for an impeachment inquiry where all of these hearings are televised. If the American public saw the nonsense that Hope Hicks and those six White House attorneys pulled last week when they objected to every single question, even where her desk was situated in the White House, the American people need to see this stuff. And I think public opinion, even among the 40% of idiots who support this guy, would turn against him.
Well, if nothing else, one of the things that would be much more appropriate is you get the likes of McGahn and some of the other lawyers for the president who could articulate this issue. And again, this is the important point, I think, is that what we don't have here is we don't have transparency that says these people speak for themselves. We're not going to have anybody spinning it for them. We simply put them on the stand and say, what happened?
Yes.
Just tell us what happened. And if they come out and they say, you know what, the president wasn't smart enough to do this, and he just took advantage of an opportunity that came his way, fine. Then let's say that, if that's what it is. Or you take it a step further and say he knew about it, he organized it, he set it up, and he made it happen. Okay, say that. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened. I think the problem is when we can't decide that A is A and B is B, because we don't even know what A or B are anymore, and there's nobody's actually reporting accurately, or we won't believe what reports even say, We are in a very, very serious crisis in this country.
Yes. And as you said, you just circling back as we wrap this up to when we were talking about the criminal court and the rule of law, we have a president, current day president in the United States of America, who thumbs his nose at the rule of law. He is telling current and former White House employees that they should just ignore congressional subpoenas. He is saying that his senior advisor, Kellyanne Conway, who's been recommended to be removed from her post because of repeat violations of the Hatch Act, too bad. He is thumbing his nose at the rule of law on every conceivable front. And my fear, and the fear of a lot of, much more educated and knowledgeable people than me, is that if our current Congress doesn't do something to hold this administration accountable, then there will be no more congressional oversight of any executive branch in the future.
Well, it's a petrifying possibility, because if we look at our legal system, if we look at our judiciary, if we look at the legislature, if we look at the executive branch, the whole concept was that these were three legs of a stool.
Mm-hmm.
Each has to hold up the other. Each
right.
has to oversee the other. Because if you have one who can unilaterally do whatever they want and then stymie the rest, or the others will simply sit on their hands and do absolutely nothing, the ability of the executive branch in this particular case will lead you towards authoritarianism.
Yes.
And it just will. And in this case, if what we're going to see is a Congress that does not litigate this, does not take this up to the Supreme Court, and actually fight this issue, because they've got to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Republicans, and when I say Republicans, I'm not talking about Trumpian Republicans. I'm talking about Republicans. There are a lot of conservatives in this country who look at Donald Trump and say, shh, at least he's doing a couple of things we like, but they hate what he's doing, and they hate how he's taken the party. And I think there's a lot of them who have to be looking at this issue and say, my God, there's going to come a time, whether it's 2020, 2024, 2028, whatever, there's going to come a time when there's a Democrat in the White House. And if that Democrat does what this president is doing,
mm-hmm.
oh my God. And I'm hoping that they're going to realize that there's a bigger question, and the question moves far beyond who he is. It has to move into, again, something we referred to much earlier in this conversation, you and I, about who we are and about what we stand for.
Yes.
And about how we approach these issues.
Absolutely. The future of our democratic republic is on the line. And I think Nancy Pelosi, in her delaying tactics because of political ramifications she fears, is putting the future of our nation in jeopardy.
I think in the end, more than anything else, we need to start litigating those issues. Specifically, the ones that I'm thinking of are where you have Congress fulfilling their constitutional obligations to provide oversight. When you think crimes are being committed, when their job is to investigate when you think bad things are being done.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're required to do. And to simply sit back and say, well, you know what? The president decided he's not going to allow it to happen. That simply is unacceptable. That can't work.
Absolutely.
So I think based upon that, I'm curious to see where they take this. Now, to the credit of the judiciary and the intelligence communities, both of them are really stepping up here and saying, we need to look at this much differently. There's one Republican in the mix right now saying there should be at least an inquiry into impeachment.
Yes.
Now, even if we're not going there, at bare minimum, we have to look at the issues and say, if we're going to subpoena people, they better show up. And the president's efforts to potentially obstruct those issues are separate issues that they should equally be looking at.
Yes.
And then driving those up to the Supremes again.
Absolutely.
Although, let's face it, you look at how the court is tilted.
Uh-huh.
I'm concerned about that.
You and me both. No, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. Hopefully, the subpoena that was issued last night that resulted in a date set certain for Mueller to testify before Congress, July 17th, was done. Maybe this will light the fire under the Democrats to get on the ball and hold these people accountable. Because because frankly, I'm sick of people just deciding they're not going to show up. They're not going to comply with a subpoena. If Congress doesn't do anything, or say if the Democrats don't do anything to get a hold on this, then there is no rule of law left in this country. Jack Rice, we could keep going. Go ahead.
Yeah, we could go on forever on this. I really am looking forward to listening to Mueller speak. I think the entire country has been waiting for this. They want to see it.
July 17th, we have a date. Jack Rice, I could talk to you for hours, and I'm so glad you're back. And hopefully we can check in from time to time and try to figure out what's happening in this crazy world that we're living in.
such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
For me, too. Jack Rice. People can find you, of course, jackrice.org on Twitter and Facebook, Jack Rice. And so you're back for a while now, yes? Or no?
Yeah, I'm going to be going up into Sweden and then over into the Baltics next month. But that'll be relatively quick.
Okay. Well, we'll be in touch. Jack Rice, thank you so much. Always appreciate your expertise.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Jack Rice, everybody. And with that, we've come to the end of another program. Thank you for hanging out tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, NBC. We'll watch the debate. Tomorrow, we'll rehash it. We'll find out what the Supreme Court ruled on its two big outstanding decisions. And we'll have Mike Lux back to help me wade through it all. Thank you for listening. As always, I'm Nicole Sandler. Truly appreciate your presence and your support. Until tomorrow, keep the faith, baby. Bye.